Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 63, section 5, which is old single column, page 715. All right, we're moving along through this extended description of how the Andonites got started. And as you can tell, from the title of this section, we're very much moving on now from the immediacy of the lives of Andon and Fonta themselves. Really getting into the extensive proliferation of those peoples, and spreading to the four corners of the accessible earth. Right? I don't think there's too much we really need to doing more in the way of preface. Let's just jump in, and you'll see that they're definitely going to begin to get us in a mode that we'll very much be in once we get to the next paper of touching upon ever more issues that our scientists have stumbled upon, little tidbits of. So they'll be giving us clues about how to synchronize this story with its accurate details with the discoveries that humans have made and the never-ending rationalization schemes that humans have generated to try to explain, the data that they've stumbled upon. There's a lot of erroneous interpretations that have to be sorted through. And so they give lots of little clues to help pin that down. All right, let's see what they say here.
Section 5, Dispersion of the Andonites. The early Andon races did not penetrate very far into Asia, and they did not at first enter Africa. The geography of those times pointed them north, and farther north these people journeyed until they were hindered by the slowly advancing ice of the third glacier.
Remember how they told us that back when we were chronologically stepping through the end of the geologic eras, and they pointed out that that it was just as the third glacier was advancing southward that humans came up on the scene. So they're reminding us of that. So there's been remember there was a little over a million years of glaciation before that, with two advances and recessions, that preceded the humans. So the area to the north has experienced a lot of reworking already by the time the humans head up north and can go further north when the glaciers recede. All that original territory has gotten seriously changed. You can't help but notice that the early ones did not at first enter Africa, so much for the out of Africa rationalization scheme for everything today. All the data that they find, no matter where they find it today, they have what's currently an unquestionable assumption in play that it originated in Africa and spread from there. And you can't be too hard on them. There were many species of advanced, apes, basically, right? Simian tribes, if you will, there in Africa, that they think are the immediate precursors. And, there's a shred of truth to that, as we'll start to see here, of, the Andonites, when they went to Europe, backmating with some of those stocks that were penetrating up from Africa. There's a high degree of subhuman out of Africa, right? That got blended into mankind, but not human. Humans went into Africa, and just see the fact that it was quite a while before they did, makes it all the more appear, right? That that you had those very primitive things, and then eventually, as they look at the data, they must have come out of Africa, and you have these more advanced ones outside of Africa. Again, it's just it's very, you can rationalize anything. It's very easy to take a set of data and rationalize it in lots of different ways. It can appear to be many things. But what is it really? That's the difficult element to determine, and many things can't be determined without that reality being revealed. And that's the purpose of revelation, to reveal the reality behind the appearances. We just can't get at.
Which unfortunately opens the door for people to say, well, the revelation's wrong. Or is it really a revelation? There's two sides to that as well, I think.
Right, of course, and that's because they don't understand what a revelation is, right? I mean, humans have always...
Some that do.
But see, again, even those that quote-unquote do, see, don't. The fact that think that way, that's my whole point. I mean, they think, they allow for the word revelation, but they interpret it the way humans always have. A revelation is when someone tells you that what you've always thought is correct. Right? They think of revelation as affirmation. Right? A superhuman affirmation, right, is a revelation. No. If you had any humility, obviously, if you actually got any sort of superhuman input, it's going to be in conflict with your thoughts.
Or it couldn't be there.
Right? And the main reason, there's a natural tendency to go down that path. But remember, 200,000 years ago, there was an influence that cultivated this and has been ever since, that your thoughts are innately divine. Right? It's that insidious message that Caligastian crew fed into humankind 200,000 years ago, and we still are steeped in it. We have this strong tendency to think we've got it, and the best that someone on high could do is affirm that for us.
Do you think that's still left over from that?
Definitely is. Don't underestimate...
Nobody knows about them.
Yeah, don't underestimate how religiously we will imitate something for generation after generation after generation. There's many places in the book where they try to point that out. As a matter of fact, I think there's one coming up. Yeah, there's one coming up on the next page. Just how indelible some of these things are. They can be started a million years ago and be maintained completely oblivious to its origins, unchanged a million years later. All right, so it definitely starts out with that. Just, you can see that they knew where we were heading. Eventually we would get it all rationalized where we would think it would be out of Africa. So, like I said, just as soon as they start talking, kind of in the mode where you're going to be wanting to compare this to what humans have found and think, you've got that statement right up front. No, it's not out of Africa. It's eventually into Africa. All right.
Before this extensive ice sheet reached France and the British Isles, the descendants of Andon and Fanta had pushed on westward over Europe and had established more than 1,000 separate settlements along the great rivers leading to the then warm waters of the North Sea.
See, another little reminder. Yeah, so you can see how they're giving you little tidbits from back when we were talking about the glacier, you know, the ice age. That little tidbit. Remember, in order to sustain the ice age, you have to have open, warm, polar waters. Otherwise, you're not going to have evaporation. You're not going to have snow. Right? And snow and snow and snow and snow, right? So unlike today, the North Sea back then was warm waters. Kind of not so much now. Interesting. Yeah, so just, they're reminding you that again of just how different it was back then.
You always think of the ice age as being cold. I mean, you think what they said here thinks, you'd think the ice was almost to the North Sea by now. They're saying almost reach France, which is right there.
But see, again, there's warm water, so you're not going to have ice,
No, I realize that.
At
some point, doesn't it?
Remember,
warm water away.
Yeah, like they said, remember, eventually you get enough of a continental climate set in that the waters in the poles start to get cold, right? And then they freeze over, and then all the evaporation stops, right? And that's the state we're in now. But again, until finally the ice age is over. One way or another, all that ice will eventually go away.
We need a global cooling event.
Yes, this was before the great global cooling, yes, quote unquote, yes. All right, let's keep going here.
These Andonic tribes were the early river dwellers of France. They lived along the river Somme for tens of thousands of years. The Somme is the one river unchanged by the glaciers, running down to the sea in those days, much as it does today. And that explains why so much evidence of the Andonic descendants is found along the course of this river valley.
See, so there's your first kind of definitive example of paralleling to archaeology that we have. The River Somme is a fascinating location on the planet. I mean, I'm sure a number of you know it's super famous, for military history, going, way back. And if you don't know it goes way back, you've probably have heard of, how famous it is in World War I. But it was also one of the very key initial places that they started finding evidence that there was, quote-unquote, antediluvian man, back when you were rationalizing everything relative to the flood. And that's what they're pointing out, that when we find all those flint tools there, you're finding Andonite tools. Okay? And, and they're even helping you a bit with dating, because sometimes it's kind of tricky to date some of this stuff if you find some of these things in a gravel pit, what the heck, date are they? It's a little hard to tell sometimes. But obviously it's somewhere not too far subsequent from a million years ago that they're up there. So, it wouldn't be surprising if some of those actually are pushing a million years old. You'd certainly expect somewhere in the 500,000 to, say 900,000 years ago range. And they're pointing out there are tens of thousands of years. And this is just some imitating, this tendency to imitate. A group of humans come up with a certain way to make a dwelling or whatnot, it just goes on. I mean, not changed one iota for tens of thousands of years. Look at sites in North America of Amerinds, and see how over vast spans of time, the way they made teepees or something was just utterly unchanged. There's a lot of place-like nature in this un-Adamic uplifted stock. Adam and Eve's uplift gets a lot more directional consciousness into the humans. The first, you know, these pre-sangic races, and then the, you know, and then the six sangic races, with the first six adjutants, you know, being favored, you know, one for each. There's a lot of place-like there. And, you know, that favoritism for the seventh adjutant that comes with the Adamic uplift brings in some directionality. Basically because it's allowing the directioning of spirit influence upon mind to come down and engage, you know, through the seventh adjutant, you know, the foundational adjutants underneath, you know, and really give it a directionality. So, you know, the River Psalm is, you know, is a very seminal location for, you know, some of the very first ancient, you know, human evidence.
How does it run through France? Is it,
you know? It's you know, right in the north, flowing into the English Channel.
And it starts now?
It starts just, you know, not very, it's not a very long.
Flows
northward, yeah. Yeah. And you know, you can just picture that, you know, the very fact that it's kind of that direction, you know, it wasn't flowing crosswise where glaciers would, you know, just totally plow it over and, you know, totally change it. So it's just coincidentally, like they're saying, it ends up being a location that didn't get scraped. And so there's evidence that goes way back. So you can, you know, you can easily look up stuff about that. It was a French archaeologist that, you know, first found it, and you know, and it was back there in the 19th century, it was a big hullabaloo. I mean, you know, this is, you know, you're still in that, I mean, you're beginning to challenge the biblical rationalization scheme, you know, for everything. And so, you know, this was a very big deal. Everybody, you know, was, you know, going there and checking the out, you know, what he had found. And
last one.
Okay. I mean, that's the thing. The more that you know the history, the more you would appreciate why the Revelators just sort of allude to something rather than explaining in detail. Because if you know anything about what they're talking about, they don't need to say anything. All they have to do is just give a hint. All they have to do is say River Sum, and boom, you know the rest of the story. They're assuming that you have all of that human part of the picture, and they're just giving you little tidbits, you know, on top of that. All right.
These aborigines of Urantia were not tree dwellers. Though in emergencies, they still betook themselves to the treetops. They regularly dwelt under the shelter of overhanging cliffs, along the rivers, and in hillside grottos, which afforded a good view of the approaches and sheltered them from the elements. They could thus enjoy the comfort of their fires without being too much inconvenienced by the smoke. They were not really cave dwellers either, though in subsequent times, the later ice sheets came farther south and drove their descendants to the caves. They preferred to camp near the edge of a forest and beside a stream.
Now, if it's not obvious, look at how they're giving you all sorts of hints of, you know, where you'd want to focus to try to find some place that didn't get scraped, right, that fits these parameters, you know. So giving you all those clues, so that you don't have to be guessing. It's like, well, what sort of norms, you know, did they have? You know, I mean, they're giving you all those basic norms. So great stuff for the scientists, you know, to all the places you might look, you know, start with these biases of locale. You know, just how, you know, they just needed a little bit of shelters. They didn't need to go into deep caves. And then it was handy because then you didn't have the smoke building up in the cave and having to try to figure out how to, you know, deal with that. You know, if it's just a little grotto, you know, the smoke didn't naturally went out. And so, you know, they're definitely thinking. Right? You know, they're being selective and creative in their use of the natural situation to work with their budding technology of fire and stuff. Let's see. I guess that's pretty much what we have there. Maybe one little thing you might wonder, because sometimes when you see these, you know, these deep cave locations that they find, you know, in some places there in Europe, you know, like in France, you're thinking, well, gee, maybe smoke didn't really bother them that much or whatnot. And it's like, no, they're just like you. I mean, right? They didn't want to sit there and breathe smoke, you know, any more than you do right now. So, you know, it had to be something very severe to be driving them, you know, into deep caves. All right. Okay. Yeah. Keep going here.
With the overhanging.
Oh yeah. Right.
Yeah. About
well, you know, I mean, again, you know, they didn't have so little control over their fear that they couldn't deal with, yeah, you know, that calamity with Andon and Fonta. You know, and it's like, well, okay, yeah, that's kind of scary, but right, it is what it is. We're gonna have to just, you know, suck it up here and. Maybe we'll kind of notice areas where there's less earthquake activity, and we'll, you know, be more selective. Now, if only humans were like that today, you know, we still have humans building all sorts of elaborate stuff in areas that, you know, that there's an extremely high probability that an earthquake is going to flatten all of it, you know, mm-hmm, before, you know, in your lifetime, you know.
Yeah.
The
other thing about caves is they're not common.
Yeah.
Many caves are there? There's, yeah. I mean, there are not probably many more caves then than there are today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're just not, if you were just limited to living in caves, you wouldn't have much of an opportunity.
Yeah, and you'll see there's, you know, the next thing they talk about here addresses that a little bit. Like, well, what if you run out of, you know, little shallow grotto things here, you know? Okay.
They very early became remarkably clever in disguising their partially sheltered abodes and showed great skill in constructing stone sleeping chambers, dome-shaped stone huts into which they crawled at night. The entrance to such a hut was closed by rolling a stone in front of it, a large stone which had been placed inside for this purpose before the roof stones were finally put in place.
So you can kind of picture this is like, you know, like a Far Side cartoon or something. The first one, it's like, don't! Oh, I should have put the stone in before I put the roof on. Eventually it sunk in.
It's already nighttime. Reminds you of the stone in front of Jesus' tomb.
Yeah. So, you know, just to your point, C. Gene, a couple things there. One, they're, you know, being clever about hiding, you know, those places where they were. And then, you know, when they didn't have anything, they figured out how to, you know, just for the safety while they're sleeping, they crawl into this little stone igloo, you know, basically. And, you know, and be protected. You know, all that, you know, what was that?
They don't tell us how long it took.
They don't tell you how long, but they do point out just how remarkably clever, right? I mean, because, you know, you think about it, you know, that's a tricky thing to build something, a dome that doesn't collapse on you out of rocks.
Yeah.
Right? You know, how long did it take before, you know, you had, you know, Renaissance, you know, architects doing that sort of stuff, you know, or whatnot. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, you know, very creative, reflective assessment of the situation to figure out exactly how to shape stones and whatnot, you know. And, you know, undoubtedly there was some trial and error learning, you know. It wasn't all insight, you know, perfect the first time. You know, Grog got squashed, and so they didn't, you know, make it like that anymore. But, But nonetheless,
it's just a gravestone now.
Yeah, it does. They do seem to indicate it wasn't just all learning by leaping. And the fact that they said remarkably clever, that indicates that the life carriers watching this, were delighted at just how much insight these primitive creatures were mustering. Right. Okay.
The Andonites were fearless and successful hunters, and, with the exception of wild berries and certain fruits of the trees, lived exclusively on flesh. As Andon had invented the stone axe, so his descendants early discovered and made effective use of the throwing stick and the harpoon. At last, a tool-creating mind was functioning in conjunction with an implement-using hand, and these early humans became highly skillful in the fashioning of flint tools. They traveled far and wide in search of flint, much as present-day humans journey to the ends of the earth in quest of gold, platinum, and diamonds.
So you can see the point there. I mean, there's the immediate thing of, it has that extreme desirability, like gold, platinum, and diamonds, they're just pointing that out. But also, what tended to drive them ever further from their homeland? Because like I said a little bit ago, it's not like we have Adamic uplift here and we have Andites that just have an insatiable inner desire to head towards the horizon on horseback. Right, they're very place-like, so there has to be some sort of a nose ring, right? That's dragging them, any distance, and it's the quest for flint, that is taking them, ever further.
Like the Tyrian purple guys.
Yeah.
When they ran out of the seashells.
Yep. 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 In every generation, they're pointing out there tends to be something like this that. Until there's that inner drive, and then the other little thing we talked about how, way before there were the first humans, there were the beginnings of stone tool making, crude stone tool making. Some of those near human strains, had been making tools, crude tools for a long time. But when you start to get to something besides just a crudely chipped stone, when you start to get to throwing sticks, harpoons, right, and remember his axe, where he's, strapping it to a, the chipped stone to a club, and right, when it gets sophisticated like that, it's not merely a fancy animal, using the fourth adjutant. It takes some top-down, reflective assessment, contexting, that only a human has to think in such coordinated fashion like this. Right. So that's a way that you can when all you have to go by is the tools, if you want to ask yourself, it's like, well. Were these individuals, for instance, were these severely back-mated individuals that really had basically lost their human quality, in this one area where I'm finding them on the planet? Well, are there tools just basically crude sort of things? Or is there any sort of a sophistication like this, where you're putting multiple pieces together, for instance, or whatnot? That would indicate some level of human quality of mind. Even if biologically they're compatible with humans, their mind is inferior if it doesn't have that, that sophistication, that delicateness of conceptualization to it. All right. There's one of the famous things, there's what they call hand axes, these large flints, that were meant to be. They had a big, end on one end, you grab in your hand and you could, use as a hand axe. Those are very common classic pieces from way back then. Let's see here. Anything else there? Oh yeah, just you know, we'll see coming up here in a little bit. The it's not obvious immediately here, but when we're talking about they lived exclusively on flesh, initially it's raw. There's no cooking happening initially. Yeah. So it's raw meat and you know, some berries and fruit thrown in. You know, and so obviously, you know, that's a lot of wear and tear on teeth, and but we need a little bit more reflective, you know, consciousness to come in, just put some more pieces together. You're like, oh, I know. How about if we cook the meat? You know, and so you'll see that's coming up here shortly. Okay.
And in many other ways, these Andon tribes manifested a degree of intelligence which their retrogressing descendants did not attain in 500,000 years, though they did again and again rediscover various methods of kindling fire.
Yeah, so that's, you know, we'll get into the details of that in the next paper, all of that backmating. but you can see what they're hinting at in just that one little pithy paragraph there, that... most of what we're going to find is going to make it appear that humans weren't very sophisticated back then. You know, there's so little recognition that if you could somehow find it, you know, if it exists. You know, there are going to be humans from 1,000,000 years ago that are what we would consider quite modern. Mm-hmm. You know, but we're finding, you know, in general, ones where there's some degree, if not a lot, of backmating. Okay, and so, before we get out of this, they'll touch upon that. But, you know, that's led to a lot of bias of, you know, quote unquote, cavemen. You know, we're technically back where we're dealing with Homo erectus, you know, what humans have come to call Homo erectus. But most of that, those Homo erectus fossils, are either subhuman strains, you know, like, say, in Africa that, you know, are not directly involved in what we're talking about here. You know, that you know, were some of those strains that, you know, that got backmated with, or they're Andonites that there was a high degree of backmating with, you know. But there, you know, theoretically, there is a quote-unquote Homo erectus skeleton that would be quite, you know, modern-looking. Right? If you had some of these uncorrupted individuals from way back here that they're describing. So, you know, see, just, and you can just get the sense of the way they said that. I mean, it was relatively short-lived, right, that you had this sophisticated intelligence, and then it, you know, there was just, in general, a retrogression. You know, to the point where literally they're having to rediscover kindling fire over and over and over again. Just, you know, see just how severe that backmating was. Yeah.
Do they tell us how much retrogression there was?
Yeah, in 2 degrees, yeah. I mean, you know, basically they give you the clues that you need where you can just look at the fossils and think, oh, well, wow, look at how big the brow ridges are on this one, you know, how robust this skull is, you know, how little forehead there is, how, you know, how small the you know, the brain, you know, cavity is in relative terms, et cetera. Right? And they're giving you that information so we can start assessing all of it, you know, all the data that way, you know, and not so much thinking of, well, this must be a different, totally different species here, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, no, this is an Andonite that's, you know, that's backmated a little. This is an Andonite that's backmated quite a lot. you know, we can start to think about the remains that we have in those terms. You know, rather than thinking of something as of it all coming up from something prior and having all these different flavors, you know, actually you kind of just had, you know, the one main up thrust, you know, and then it's sifting back into a whole bunch of different flavors. Yeah. All right. So anyway, like I said, we'll get into a lot of that sort of discussion as they kind of get us into a chronological mode again, stepping through all this, you know, yet again in the next paper. Okay.
Section 6, Anagar, the first truth teacher. As the Andonic dispersion extended, the cultural and spiritual status of the clans retrogressed for nearly 10,000 years until the days of Anagar, who assumed the leadership of these tribes, brought peace among them, and for the first time led all of them in the worship of the breath giver to men and animals.
Okay. So this is a, you know, very big deal. We have our first exemplary individual. Let's see. I didn't think to mark that. Let's see, where is that way back when we touched upon the 24 counselors here? You know, if you recall, that's a paper 45, section 4. You know, the first individual that, you know, in that list that ended up on the 24 counselor commission there was Anagar. You know, as they described him there, the mastermind of the pre-planetary prince age who directed his fellows in the worship of the breath giver. You know, he's the only one, you know, that became a part of that group until post-planetary prince, as you can kind of tell by, you know, what they were, you know, saying just there.
That's a long time.
Yes, a very long time, right? So that's first 500,000 years in terms of an exemplary individual, you know, so much so that they ended up in that very select group of the 24 counselors, just one, Anagar. And very early on, you know, note that as well. I mean, just 10,000 years after Annan Infanta. You know, and eventually they'll tell you when he is born here in this section. And, you know, you can see here when they say nearly 10,000, that's because, you know, the context, see, the clan retrogressed for nearly 10,000. There was a little chunk of time at the beginning, kind of like they're hinting at in that previous paragraph, right, when things were staying fairly integrous. But remember, they mentioned that, you know, after 20 generations, you know, there started to be issues. And, you know, so it wasn't very long, you know, a few hundred years, handful of hundreds of years, that they're nipping off of this time between the birth of Annan Infanta and the birth of Anagar to make it less than 10,000 here. But, you know, in very short order, things started to retrogress. And you had some solid enough strains that were remaining that you could get this exemplary individual still come out of it. But the fact that, right, it was just 10,000 years and, you know, the remaining, you know, 490,000 years, right, no one, again, speaks to how much backmating, how much retrogression there was.
For him to do that, to lead them into worship, even if, you know, to this low level, but
yeah,
it just says how strong it is if we don't turn away, what the potential is there.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these you know, these responses, these religious responses to stimuli, are very fundamentally programmed into us, if you will, you know, in the way the adjutants function, you know, in particular the sixth adjutant as the religious impulse. It's there, and it is going to, it's going to have a response, an instinctual response to certain stimuli, to, you know, especially fear-based elements of your life. It's going to have some sort of a response to that. You know, like they pointed out, everything is already in place. But why did it take 10,000 years for something significant? Because, again, we needed an individual to kind of go up a notch again, to have a little bit more reflective mind, right? To get to the point where you can see what he's doing here. You've got the first individual that's going, okay, I know there's something more to me than merely my body. There's not body. I don't know exactly what it is, but I know there's not body. And the first thing that humans turn to as an answer to that question, what is the not body part of me? You know, they knew it had to be something quite intangible, quite not body-like, you know, not tangible like your body. And the most intangible thing that they could experience about us that they decided must be this not body part of us, quote-unquote our mind, right? I mean, effectively, they're looking for mind, in contrast to body, is breath, right? And so, you know, and that's remained unchanged to this day. You know, we still speak in those terms that Onagar taught us to speak in, even though we have no idea that that's who taught us to speak that way. You know, we still, you know, and Jesus played into it. And, you know, it's part of the way we think, you know, the breath of life. And so you take that most rarefied, transcendent aspect that you can conceive of yourself, which is, you know, technically you're trying to get to your mind, you know, reflectively thinking and distinguishing mind from body, but deciding, you know, it's breath. And so you take that most transcendent element that you've conceived of and you just exalt it to God, right? God becomes the source of breath, right? The breath giver. You know, and that's just what humans have always done, right? They take the most transcendent thing that they've conceived of and they just lift it up as high as they can and, you know, give it a capital letter, and that's God, right? Right, so, but just notice something that, got lost and rediscovered, and, you know, it's not breath giver to men only. Breath giver to men and animals. See, you know, just, you know, that early on, appreciating that there was something in common. You know, there were times not so long ago when humans convinced themselves that, you know, animals didn't have minds. They didn't have not body. Right? You know, once you're not thinking that it's literally the breath, you know, right? You know, not being so materialistic about your quote-unquote mind concept. But he had a sense. I mean, you don't want to underestimate him, you know, think, well, he's just, you know, it's cold and, you know, he sees the animals, you know, the fog when they're breathing and the humans fog and, you know, and he's just doing something simplistic. No, he's not. It's very important. See, he's gotten up, he's genuinely reflecting and recognizing that experientially you know that there's more to you than body, that there's what we now call mind. And that's the big step. Before that, you know, Andon and Fonta and their immediate descendants for those first 10,000 years, there was no one that could get enough reflective thinking to really recognize that there was something besides body. It all just seemed understandable, their experiences of being nothing but body. And see, until you have something not body, it's difficult to get a genuine God concept, right, that you can form, right? And you also can't get any sort of a life after death idea going, really. See? You need something not body that you can imagine goes on when the body obviously goes ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Now, they were very matter of fact back in those days. They didn't have some wild magical notion that, you know, the dust became a body again, right? You know, the resurrection of the body, you know. Right? They were more sophisticated a million years ago than we are today in that regard. And so, you know that you can give him this kind of quality of mind, even if he didn't have a sophistication of expressing it. You can give him that quality of mind because where does he end up? Right, on the 420 counselors, okay? And an Infanta didn't end up on the 420 counselors, okay? I mean, this is an exemplary mind, okay?
He's thinking of a giver, too.
Yeah, see, and having that causal consciousness, see, you know, I mean,
right,
there has to be a source. He's thinking, the first cosmic intuition is getting more sophisticated here. He's thinking causally, there has to be a source for something. You can't get something from nothing. See, he's already understanding that. But now the greatest minds believe you can get something from nothing. Anagar would never believe in the Big Bang Theory.
True.
He was more intelligent than that. This is important stuff to just, you know, the first truth teacher. See, that's an important thing in that title. He's got enough going on in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of his mind, right, that he's beginning to, his personality is beginning to encompass the wholeness of truth in a beginning conscious way, right? And it's having significant effects. Once you wrap your mind around truth, the existence of God is self-evident. Now, your idea of God is going to be limited to your worldview, but the ideal of God is there, right? And the idea of God is still limited to our worldview. That's why this, one of the reasons this book is in my lap. You know, yes, you've got the ideal of God, but your ideas of God are in some ways not even as high quality as Anagar's. Okay? You know, you've got some issues with your ideas of God. They're very primitive, not pre-primitive. Okay. Ideal, fine. You got the ideal, you know, especially if you've really resonated with the fourth epical revelation, you got that spiritual uplifting. And okay, so you've got a valid ideal of God, but your ideas of God are not commensurate. Right? They're pitiful.
You mean the magical? Are you talking about the magical God?
Right, I mean, you know, magical and just grotesquely primitive and foolish, you know, in so many ways. Illogical, an illogical God. A rationalized, you know, notion, but not logical.
Hateful, vengeful,
punishing. And you can give him all sorts of those, you know, primitive attributes, and you can rationalize it all, you know, you can rationalize anything. You can rationalize magic. Right, the best minds on the planet are doing it all the time these days, and all their theories are magical. They're rational. You can, right?
There's math behind.
Right, you can rationalize magic. Right? You can make magic rational. And in order for J.K. Rowling to write Harry Potter, she has to make magic rational. But no matter how rational you make magic, it'll never be logical. It's innately illogical. No matter how elaborately rational you make it. Okay. If you don't rationalize magic, you can't tell a story. I mean, you know, if it's irrational, you can't tell a story. There has to be some, you know, some scheme, some rationalization scheme, right? I mean, or you can't write it, you know, it's impossible to write a story. If everything is just completely random and haphazard, right, there's no story.
They can't really fly on those brooms.
But you come up with, you know, they can do this, but they can't do that. And you go, well, why? You know, I mean, it's illogical that they can do one thing and they can't do another thing. Right? If it's magical, you can do anything. Right? Why would there be some limit? Right? But if you don't set limits, if you don't make it rational, I mean, then you can't tell a story. Right? You can't have it so that, you know, they can just think it and the universe disappears. But technically, if there was magic, you know, you, just as much as you could make that cup disappear, you could make the universe disappear. The size wouldn't be an issue. Right? Logically, there's no difference. But, you know, you rationalize there's a difference. You create this rationalization, you know, so that otherwise the story is impossible. Right? You can't have someone, so the baddie in the story being able to just blink and make the universe disappear. Right? That won't work. He has to have limits. He has to be able to be overcome somehow, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, anyway, just, you know, that's what we're trying to get at. You've got the first quality mind that is getting some conscious logic in play. Not just rationalization. Not just ever fancier second adjutant. Right? Anagar. Yep.
And I'm glad you straightened me out, but when I first thought of the breath, you know, the breath, I was thinking also of the spirit versus the mind, and which is also a part of us, you know, in a way, and maybe that's another step up. You know, after you get used to the concept of mind, then you can get into the concept of spirit. That was probably not involved here in this case.
Yeah, remember, humans still don't have it. Humans still don't have three things.
Well, they have them.
We have the words mind and spirit, but historically there's never been a difference.
Most people would describe a difference.
See, and most of the words that we use, like the word spirit, say, or animate, or what, all those words, you know what they literally mean? Breath. All those words mean breath, right? Because of anagar. Right, you know, you got Latins coining words, Greeks coining words, right? All of them are just the same thought that anagar started. Those words, the word spirit means breath. Right? So technically, we haven't gone anywhere. See,
he wasn't talking about spirit though.
No,
breath, even though.
No one that uses the word spirit means spirit. There isn't any human that's ever used the word spirit, that by that word meant another substance in the external world.
Maybe one human.
Right?
Jesus,
right? I mean, obviously, right? I mean, you know, especially
there's spirit of God within you, and there's spirits that influence you, like the adjutant mind. Spirit.
Yeah, but see, all of those, everyone, you know, when Jesus said spirit. Right, that was, you know, everyone interpreted that in the old, you know, dualistic system, you know, of, you know, where initially, I breathe my last breath. Okay, and that's the eternal me that went out of me. Okay, and that becomes my ghost. My breath becomes my ghost. And eventually we went from ghost to kind of abstracting it another notch and calling it a spirit. But that's just a little more abstracted and solidified breath. And that's why the word spirit is the word breath. You know? There's no one that's ever recognized that. To engage spirit, that's an aspect of your outer life, a new outer life. The only thing in your inner life is mind. Right? So,
even though the spirit of God works in your mind, it's still a spirit, correct?
Well, see, now technically, there's a reason why they don't very much use the expression spirit fragment for the thought adjuster, because
Holy Spirit. They use the Spirit.
Yeah, but where the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth, are those in your mind? No, those are above your mind.
Right?
Because they're outside of your mind. They're actual spirit ministries, you know, in spirit energy. They're not a mind ministry. You know, the only reason that the thought adjuster can be quote-unquote in your mind is not because it's a quote-unquote spirit fragment. That gives it a direct connection to your Marantia object, your soul, which is also outside of your mind. The only reason it can be within your mind is because technically it's not a spirit fragment. It's a deity fragment. And deity, you know, one of the crude ways you can think about deity as a substance, it's like mind-made substance. Right? It's innately minded. Right? It can be within your mind because deity is innately minded. It's mind-like in its nature. And so it can, but the Holy Spirit is not mind-like. It's spirit ministry. It's above your mind. So is the Spirit of Truth.
So the adjutants in a way?
No, the adjutants are mind energy.
They're spirit.
No, they're adjutant minds, mind hyphen spirits. That's because they're worded that way because they're coming down from spirit, but they're literal mind energy. Okay. Right, so again,
good. Well,
see now, and all this stuff. I mean, this is what Reawakening Philosophy One is all about. You know, is going through all these details, learning about, you know, learning the human philosophy that you're expected to know before you start reading the Revelation. So that you know what they're referring to, right? You know the significance of the breath giver to men and animals, right? You go, oh, that whole initial thought, I mean, philosophers have known for a long time, you know, that that's the way humans have been rationalizing everything forever. And now you go, oh, and guess who started it? Onagar, almost 1 million years ago. He was the one that thought that up. You know, that wasn't some, you know, ancient, you know, Hebrew guy. No, Onagar thought that up a long time ago. You know, and one of the main reasons he thought it up is because they went north and the third glacier is in their face and it's cold. You know, you see your breath. Right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so back to the story here. See that. Notice there at the start of that, as the endonic dispersion extended, the cultural and spiritual status of the clans retrogressed. Okay? You know that spiritual status. I mean, how much? You know, what's the quality of the mind, the spiritualized mind in the upper domain? In the hourglass analogy, it's getting lower and lower and lower quality. Right, so. You know, it's losing all conscious, any sort of a conscious role in the day-to-day lives of these individuals, right? You know, what they have is just a super conscious, you know, thing going on. They're still technically humans, right? But it's, and until Onagar, you know, it was, there wasn't anything solid as part of their conscious life. And then, the light bulb goes on, right, for Onagar, and the insights of the three cosmic intuitions become a conscious part of his life, like, you know, like they haven't been for a long time and technically have never been this high quality. Yep.
This retrogression, is it just that meeting, or would have it happened to some degree without that meeting?
No, it is the back mating issue.
Okay.
Yeah. See, and that's why for a long time there wasn't, you know, for many generations, you know, 20, 30 generations, there wasn't any because there was no back mating. It was only when they started to, you know, break up, you know, that lesser individuals, you know, in a not so demanding cultural context succumb to your biologic tendencies to mate with anything that moves.
That's
not happening. Right? But see, before that, see, cultural and spiritual status. See, they're pointing out that, that's what I was just stressing, the cultural part there. right? I mean, above society, they have a culture, and it's, you know, it, there's a definitive expectation. It's like, you don't do that, and everyone follows that. But as soon as it starts splitting up, you know, there's, it's gonna divide along quality lines. The lesser quality individuals will pull together and drift to the south. The higher quality individuals will pull together and drift to the north. Right? And those ones that drift to the south, they're gonna find themselves face to face with things they shouldn't be mating with and do anyway.
But the moon is out. Raw meat breath thing.
Okay. So, but you get on a gar who, you know, has some, you know, not just religious, sort of technically speaking, but, you know, has beginnings of a genuine religious consciousness, not merely a religious super consciousness, but a religious consciousness. And he immediately, you know, transforms his people. It's the mustard seed thing. It only takes a few individuals to really stand up and challenge everyone. Like I was saying, that challenge was going away, see? To challenge everyone to, you know, to rise to that higher quality.
It does not seem as easy today. Modern times.
Yeah, because there's a lot more. You're not the boss of me, you know.
So
we're very renegade, you know. So people can, you know, there's individuals can hold themselves up, but you know, everyone just shrugs. Like, well, so, you know, you know, I don't have to follow that. I mean, you know, think about how much we threw off all, you know, especially when we got rid of taboo. You know, that was the only thing that kept humans together for a long time, you know, and then we got sophisticated and got rid of taboo. It's like, well, now what? You know, what keeps us between the lines? Nothing. Right? I can do any old damn thing I want. Right?
Self-assertion.
Law. You know, so. Yeah, anyway. Okay, so we've got.
But that potential's still there.
Right.
Even though.
We're humans. You know, it just.
Culturally, we're in an environment that for, since Lucifer, really, you know, we're going to rebel against whatever.
Yeah. And is the answer better for Smilers? No. We don't need more consecration of our will to the perfect will of God the Father. Mm-hmm. Right? We're still going to languish and stumble along in moral darkness. Right? A moral darkness that's worse than in Onagar's days. Okay, why? Right? It's because there's more, you know, you have to desire quality of mind, not just conviction of mind. Right? No amount of conviction is going to improve this. You have to go, people have to challenge themselves to go from ever more convicted first milers to budding second milers. Taking delight in cultivating, having a mind of some quality, not just a mind of absolute conviction. It doesn't get us anything. Man. Better Christians is not going to improve the situation. Man. It's not what we need. Right? As they tell you, point blank. I mean, you don't have to take my word for it. They tell you point blank in that second miler paragraph. Right? Right? You don't need better Christians, better first milers. You need second milers. And if you don't have some who can really foster the reinvigoration of culture and civilization, right, you're going to collapse.
In the material comfort era. Right. Yeah. We're going to exalt as materialism.
But, you know,
somebody has to stand above that.
Think about how material it was back in Onagar's day. You know, they're going about to mention. I mean, things are pretty basic and material there. They're trying to figure out how to put food in their belly, right, and not freeze to death, not get eaten by a predator. And he penetrated through, His illumination was definitive enough, right? I mean, remember, you don't have to, if you genuinely know truth, you don't have to convince someone. It's self-captivating to others, right? See, he's the first truth teacher because he's the first truth knower, right? I mean, but, you know, when everyone is still quid est veritas, everyone is in Pontius Pilate mode, you know, what is truth, right? See, that's the problem. I mean, there are no individuals that embody truth. That's why the world isn't being transformed. It's like, well, no, I have all kinds of truth. I'm very convicted. No, that isn't any truth. You know, there is no correlation between conviction and the knowing of truth.
And it's tricky because it changes, it's static, it's like it revolves. It's like,
right.
Not
to mention, you know, neither certainty nor conviction is faith. As you know, remember in the religious papers, they, you know, they're even more tough than I'm being right now.
Yeah.
All right, they're pointing out there's all kinds of people that think they have faith, and they say, "Well, no, I'm sorry to inform you that there's almost zero on your planet. You don't even know what the word faith means." You think it's conviction, you know, that it's amped up belief. Sixth adjutant plus belief equals faith. No, it doesn't. Right? Faith is something that you know nothing of, basically. So if you don't even have the spark that begins what Anagar was beginning, right? I mean, the faith nucleus spark is the center of the sphere of truth. And if you don't have the center, you can't have the sphere. If you don't have the center, hence you don't have the sphere, what's the spirit of truth doing with you? Nothing.
Waiting.
Waiting. Right, waiting.
And can you cultivate?
Yes, you can take delight in cultivating. Right? You can't get to there by extrapolating belief upwards. Right? There's a reason why we call it a leap of faith. Right? There's a divide through which you can't extrapolate bottom up. You have to step out of where you are into a place you've never imagined exists to get to the beginning, the real beginning of faith. You know, and then from there, it grows three-dimensionally. Right? You know, the sphere of truth wraps itself around that nucleus of faith. And it solidifies into a solid sphere of trust. Right? But see, that's right, all down the road. That all happens naturally. You are grown, right? But you have to choose to start. Right? The God of growth can't make something out of nothing. Right? It can't initiate you. You have free will. Right? You have to initiate the growth process. You have to choose to supply the favorable conditions. And it's sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating such choice, such initiating. And, you know, to get back to here, because we could go on that mode forever, but to get back to Anagar, I mean, you know, the reason all that is relevant to this is that's the significance of Anagar, right? He's gotten above belief, you know, that are in various amped up beliefs, you know, by the sixth adjutant predicated on fear. Right? He's taken that first leap up there and provided a genuine nucleus for truth to wrap around. Right? And he knows truth consciously, not just a super conscious possession of the individual. It's a conscious possession, and immediately it's obvious, you know, to him these basic initial reflective things that the Greeks had to rediscover, you know, in the 6th century BC. And was there something else that you had?
Well, I just find the most remarkable thing here. He assumed leadership of these tribes and brought peace among them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's right. Just pleasant and isolated.
How, like I said, how potent, you know, the Revelators tell you that if you genuinely possess truth, it's very potent, right? You'll transform those around you, right? I mean, here's a great example. He's just an instantly, he's a light shining in the darkness, and all turn towards the light, right? He doesn't have to give them a whole elaborate theology or something, you know, to rationalize it to them. It's self-evident, okay? And that's the technique the Revelators use throughout, you know, in trying to get you to turn the light on in your mind, actually allow insight to illuminate your mind for the first time. They keep throwing out little challenges, you know, that the only way you can grok what they're getting at is to use the first cosmic intuition. Go, oh, I get it. That's illogical. Ah, right? I mean, they're trying to get you to pull the cord on the light bulb up there, right? That one that you've never pulled before.
Because you reach sideways, you're reaching out.
Yeah. And they know all they have to do, that's all Anagar had to do, is just, you know, he got them to look up and, you know, and there's illumination. Right? See, there's a light shining down in your mind. But normally it's just hitting the top of your head because you don't turn your eyes up. Right? All you have to do is reflect. Remember, that's what it tells you, paper 16, section 6. All you have to do is reflect. Well, what does that technically mean? And it means you turn your eyes up to the cosmos. Oh, but my belly button is so fascinating. Introspection is so much more intriguing. My favorite thing in the universe is me. I love the way I feel in certain circumstances. Oh, I love me and my feelings. I love that way that person makes me feel, and that idea makes me feel, and that action makes me feel, and right. The illumination is hitting the top of your head. Right? Yeah. And most people go through their whole lives. It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch have ever looked up. And then their eyes are filled with illumination the moment they do. That's all it is. That's all Jesus had to do, right? If he could just get someone to turn their head up, he didn't have to say anything or do anything after that. It was all taken care of instantly.
Okay, this has to be about
Christian. This is not complicated. It's so not complicated. That's why it's sad to record. I mean, it's just so not complicated. It's like, people, seriously, this is so easy. You're given everything. All you have to do is just use it. Okay? But you have to stop being so fascinated with yourself. You know, if religion is you and your spiritual experiences, that's religion in name only. That's all about you. Religion is something that's so transcendent of self, right? It's above selfless. See, the problem with selfless is you still have to use the word self to describe it. And, you know, if you've never gotten up to a level where you can't even describe it by negating the word self, you haven't gotten to religious consciousness yet. Because it's the level above selflessness. Right? And most likely the thing that's prevented you from getting up there is prayer.
Really?
Because prayer is self-reminding. Right? When you're praying, you're thinking about yourself.
Please.
Yeah. You're asking God, you know, for something. It's like, well, no, I'm not asking for something for myself. I'm asking something for Bob. Well, why are you asking something for Bob? Well, Bob is sick, and I want God to make him better. Well, why are you asking? Well, when God is sick, I don't like the way that makes... When Bob is sick, I don't like the way that makes me feel. And I don't want to feel this way, so if you fix Bob, I won't feel this way anymore. Oh, it's all about me again. Yeah.
But you're not supposed to give prayer up.
No, but I'm just noticing. Prayer gets you all the way up, but it doesn't take you that last step.
Right. And most people do stay right there.
Right. If you have to take, until you step above prayer, you don't know worship. Because see, worship is self-forgetting. And you know, that's why they tell you, you know, so many places. Unfortunately, religions have overemphasized prayer, and that's held everyone down. It's like hanging an anchor on you, not allowing spiritual gravity to take you that final step up. Right? You know, and if you're still afraid, you won't take that step, because prayer is what you use to assuage your fear. Every time you know, it's scary, you're praying. See, again, why, that's why Jesus said, fear not. See, until you can fear not, you can't get above prayer. You can't get to worship. You can't get to genuine religious consciousness. See, so, I mean, again, back to Anagar, right? He's done this for the first time. He's gotten up there as a homo erectus, for Pete's sake. Okay? And come on.
But you're not saying don't pray. I know you're not.
Yeah. Pray towards a higher end. Pray with a transcendent goal in mind.
That's a relative.
It's not an end in itself. It's a means to an end. Prayer needs to be taught as a means to an end. There's many very important things that are means to an end. And they're good because of that. But all good things taken to extreme become bad.
Even prayer.
Even prayer.
Hard time praying for things, or it's more like you're saying a general transcendent feeling.
Prayer exists in a hierarchy, and the trick is to follow it up.
But you don't have to be specific, like I want this or that.
Yeah, again, prayers, you know, see, you know, man cannot cause growth. Well, what exact words do I use to, you know, see, again, I mean, see, we're always thinking like that, you know, give me the, you know, the recipe. Two cups of what, you know, and a pinch of what? Again, it's just, you know, it's an important thing to get to from a child of God to an adult of God. But an adult of God dwells in the domain of worship above prayer.
I think that's such a hard concept.
It is a very hard concept. It's completely abstract and incomprehensible. I can, but I'm just telling you that there's something above prayer. I don't understand that. You don't have to understand it. Just know there's something above it. And don't be satisfied until one day you find it. Right? Always be thinking, I'm going through something with this prayer. Prayer is not my destiny. Prayer is my journey to somewhere unknown. And initially unknowable. Remember, truth is a knowingness that can't be given. Right? There's nothing that anyone can say that gives you truth, that gives you what's above there. Right? What's above your normal fact thinking? You know, in prayer, you're in a fact thinking mode. There's a kind of thinking above that.
So the prayer kind of gets merged into the above.
Right. It just like, you know, the bottom mind is very much like matter. And at the top, it's very much like spirit substance. Right.
Yeah.
Just like mind merges into spirit, you might say. Right. So does prayer merge into worship.
Like how Jesus didn't like formal prayer together.
But there's a, you know, technically there's still a gap. It doesn't, you know, between mind and spirit substance. They don't literally, you know, blend right into it. And there's a gap between prayer and worship. But it's just it's a crossing a threshold. It's called thanksgiving. Right? You get up to the top of prayer, and as you're rotating, you're in thanksgiving, and when you've rotated, you're in worship. Thanksgiving is the transition state.
Sharing the inner life with God, is that a little different also?
And again, you know, an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. Nothing more, nothing less. Nothing less like sharing the inner life with goodness. That's less. Got to share it with God. And nothing more. It's just an exhibition of creature willingness. It's not technically sharing the inner life with God. It's just an exhibition of creature willingness. Because remember, it's about, you know, the consecration of your will to the perfect will of God the Father. It's a consecration of your potential to the perfect potential of God the Father. Right? Doing the will of God is nothing more or less than, you know, an exhibition of creature willingness, merely willingness. Yeah. The actual sharing, that's down the road. See, the beginning is, you know, like Machaventa tried to explain to everyone, the beginning is very simple. You don't have to actually share. You just have to be willing to share the inner life with God, the all-seeing absolute fact. And God demands everything or nothing, right? I mean, see, you get to that binary point where it's infinity or oblivion. To just stress how, how important this is, you know, how in microcosm, mostly completely unaware of what he was achieving. This is what Anagar was doing for the first time, getting this genuine start in play. And it was huge. He immediately transformed his people, right?
The first concept of God on the planet.
Right, to have, you know, and when he taught, predicated on this knowing that he had achieved, right, everyone was just very captivated by it. It's like, oh, that's really cool. I love that, those thoughts. And, you know, they just all, willingly followed suit with him, right? Which, like you were saying, is very difficult to do these days. You know, remember, the only reason that Jesus and his apostles could have the impact that they did is there was a little mini spiritual quickening that basically made people hungry. But that was gone in fairly short order. And it's not present right now like it was 2,000 years ago. And so that's why you can talk until you're blue in the face and it's like you're talking to a wall. You know, whereas an apostle 2,000 years ago could just say something and people, you know, dropped everything in excitement. Right? Yeah. That little spiritual quickening, you know, is not in place, right? So, now it's, you know, we don't have that little booster shot thing, that external influence. You know, the individual has to choose to be teachable now. And that's a very difficult thing because we've been taught in many ways to close off and not allow any illumination to come in from others. Yeah. And again, it's shades of the Kaligastia teachings. You know, you don't need all that debauchery of all these other people giving you all this enlightenment. That's a bunch of garbage, right? The third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. And I mean, you're innately divine. You have it all within you. Right? Just close it off. And, you know, and so we do. Yeah.
The illumination is hitting the top of your head.
Yep.
So you were saying the willingness to share the inner life with God. You didn't mention what you were defining there.
Oh, I
skipped that.
I did throw it in passing there. The doing of the will of God is nothing more or less than an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. That whole long-standing question that, you know, I want to do the Father's will, and so he's going to tell me, you know, to pick up the fork before the spoon, and, you know, all of these notions that humans have, right? I'm going to worship on Saturday, or I'm going to worship on, you know, all these things, you know, that's the, supposedly the doing of the will. No, no, the doing of the will of God is nothing more or less, right? See,
so that's worship.
Well, no, that's just...
What is that?
What that is just that very initial step of consecrating your will. And just, I was just stressing how it's so just an initial step. All of the details is not the consecrating of your will. All the details is not the will, it's the way. It's the consecration of your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. That's where all the complexity is, you know, and all the drawn out over time process. It's very straightforward to start, much more straightforward than humans have ever been able to grok, even though, like 4,000 years ago, Mach Event had tried to tell them it's really simple, people. No, it can't be that simple. There's got to be, you know, certain rituals that we have to do. You got to move this object like this, and you know, on Tuesdays, and you got to, you know, we always think there's got to be a whole bunch of rigmarole to the doing of the will of God, and that's because we don't understand what will is. Will is just potential.
So that doesn't really get you anywhere if you don't consecrate your mind. Period.
Yeah, you don't. You're at square one. You know, see, and that's what I'm saying. I mean, ever more fervent square one is not square two. Right? So we still languish and stumble along in moral darkness. And right? We don't have minds of any quality. Right? They're dark. Right?
That's why spiritual nature gatherings or whatever feel void. There's no substance.
Again, you know, if the whole point is let's gather together to augment feeling, right? I mean, by myself, I have a hard time feeling intensely, but I've discovered if I get together in a group and I do certain things, I get more intense feelings. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. It's all about you and your feelings, isn't it?
Clamorfest.
It's just... Feelings, nothing more than feelings, as Barry Manilow saying, right? So
it doesn't mean you don't get together groups.
It doesn't mean that you don't. It's not a dichotomy.
You have to be genuine.
You have to have goals beyond self,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. If the self is the goal, then okay, mm-hmm. Not going to go anywhere. Okay.
Was that a tangent?
That was quite a tangential thing, but like I said, I mean, it's all just basically speaking to, you know, what it means to say he's the first truth teacher. Right? That's a huge statement. The first one to know truth, and hence can teach predicated on that knowing. First person, okay. And for a long time, the last person. Almost 500,000 years.
Yeah. No uplift.
All right.
Just the boss.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. All right. Let's keep going here.
Andon's philosophy had been most confused. He had barely escaped becoming a fire worshiper because of the great comfort derived from his accidental discovery of fire. Reason, however, directed him from his own discovery to the sun as a superior and more awe-inspiring source of heat and light. But it was too remote, and so he failed to become a sun worshiper.
See where Andon and, you know, and his immediate were stuck. They, he had enough to not get caught up and become a fire worshiper. Okay, and he had enough to. It's like, yeah, and that would be silly because I mean that's a little fire. Look at that big fire, the orb, you know. The all-inspiring orb in the sky that humans have always fixated on, right? But he couldn't go there either because that was too abstract, right? He didn't have enough reflective thinking ability to go that abstract. It was intangible. I mean, fire, you can put your hands close to it. Ooh, I feel, you know, the heat, right? And I see the light in the cave, right, or whatever. The sun is just too remote. They can't think that abstractly. So he's stuck, right? He's got just enough to not be really immediately material about it, but not enough. See, like I said, finally Anagar could think abstractly enough, try to abstract mind from body, right? Technically, not body, from body, right? And to get to beginnings, and to have the beginnings of philosophy. So you notice Andon's philosophy had been most confused. So, right, there was the wholeness there, the quote-unquote philosophy was error, not truth. Right, he had a wholeness, but it was erroneous, not truthful. Anagar is the first one to make that wholeness a positive form, to overcome, to transcend, to get above the inescapable confusion. See, and technically you're nothing but, that literally means, it's poured together, if you're confused. Okay. See, what's poured together? Mind and body. And so you have, current philosophic materialist scientists, stuff that say, there isn't mind. Mind is just, is a literal separate fact. It's just the functioning of brain. Right, they're confused, like pre-Anagar. They've got mind and body poured together. They don't have enough reflective thinking to get above mind. See, initially you're in the mind. It's all you know is what's below the body. Until you can really get above the mind, right, in that spiritualized mind and look down, oh, there's two things. There's body and not body. Okay.
The Andonites early developed a fear of the elements, thunder, lightning, rain, snow, hail, and ice. But hunger was the constantly recurring urge of these early days, and since they largely subsisted on animals, they eventually evolved a form of animal worship. To Andon, the larger food animals were symbols of creative might and sustaining power. From time to time, it became the custom to designate various of these larger animals as objects of worship. During the vogue of a particular animal, crude outlines of it would be drawn on the walls of the caves, and later on, as continued progress was made in the arts, such an animal god was engraved on various ornaments.
Okay, so giving you the logical picture, you can see the obvious little hints to the archaeologists again there. Where does the whole animal worship thing get started? Well, because initially you're in which developmental epic?
Nutrition.
The nutrition epic, right? It's all about your belly and that growling sound, right? And so animals become this very definitive phenomenon. They just get exalted, and worshipped.
And it doubles as a menu, too.
And again, see, back to Andon, right? It's tangible, right? Because, and there's still an awful lot of humans today that really don't have much ability to think abstractly. If it's not tangible, it's just meaningless to them, right? It's way too abstract, right? To believe it's literally bread and wine, and you're just symbolically paralleling them to body and blood, that's too abstract. Right? You have to believe it literally in literal transubstantiation, right? That it literally is transformed. Into body and blood. Because if it's not tangible like that, it's meaningless. Right? See, again, you're in an Anagar mode. You're in an Andon mode, a pre-Anagar mode. You don't have enough reflective thinking to abstract even that much. Right? To separate the symbol from the substance. These are the things that they're teaching between the lines is, getting you to reflect on, and just noticing how, so many of our current religious notions are still You know, if they aren't tangible like body is, you know, it just doesn't mean anything. See, and again, that just demonstrates that you really have never even recognized your own mind yet. You haven't gotten above it yet. You know, you just think of yourself as a body. And it's all about what touches your body, not what touches your mind. Spirit substance is not going to touch your body. The only thing it can touch is your mind. And you have to get above it to be aware of it touching it. Right?
I suppose it's really wrenching for the onlooking life carriers that were thrilled by the little benchmarks. And then now it's been dry since however long. And it's like, geez.
The life carriers that are on, including the one that wrote this paper that's on this planet, is thrilled that we're in this room talking like this, right? He's been waiting a long time, right? Right.
He's, so it's one place they hang
he's out. Been here for 550 million years, right? waiting for something that isn't so sad to record. Some humans trying to understand again. Well, we've lost.
And then going home and practicing. And then carrying it on and on too. But not just
doing that imitation thing. It's like, well, we've been doing it like this since the Middle Ages. Let's just, no, stop. Stop. Right? Behold, all things need to become new. Right? All right.
Very early, the Andonic peoples formed the habit of refraining from eating the flesh of the animal of tribal veneration. Presently, in order more suitably to impress the minds of their youths, they evolved a ceremony of reverence which was carried out about the body of one of these venerated animals. And still later on, this primitive performance developed into the more elaborate sacrificial ceremonies of their descendants. And this is the origin of sacrifices as a part of worship. This idea was elaborated by Moses in the Hebrew ritual and was preserved in principle by the Apostle Paul as the doctrine of atonement for sin by the shedding of blood.
Unchanged. To this day.
Last Sunday.
Right. Did the Apostle Paul know anything about Andon and Fonta, you know, or Yadi? No, no. Right. On and on it goes, unchanged. It gets passed on from generation to generation for a million years.
If you can boil down this, haven't given this any thought, but. Well, maybe somewhere back in my past somewhere, but if you could boil down the line, if you could come to the line of, here we are, we have some revelation and truth flowing through these words, and we've seen the mistakes and the distractions, on and on and on and on, sacrifice, atonement, prayer holding us down, not going up to Thanksgiving, not going up to worship, which takes more time, more focus, more getting yourself out of the way. And so if you could just say, here's this line, it's like now we are at the standing at the line of putting this higher wisdom, it has to become our lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, all of this, I mean, we have endless history of every little distraction and not going to the simplicity of being with God.
Yeah, and
spending time with God.
Yeah, and just to...
millions of other things going on in the world, in life, and day to day.
Yeah, and just to kind of notice how I'm trying to emphasize, you know, we're not just reading about ancient history here, but this is, I'm trying to get it to come alive for you and see how there's a truth flowing through it that's immediately relevant. I mean, you know, if you've spent years or decades reading everything in the Urantia book but any of the, you know, historical papers. So you're missing something very big. You know, you're missing these lessons about things that humans one time had and no longer do. Or, wow, I thought that was a pretty new and cutting-edge thought. That actually goes all the way back, and it's tied to the fact that they used to eat raw, you know, animal meat. Gross. Right? See, you know, they're trying to, you know, see, they're trying to get you to, I mean, see, you know, that's why, you know what the Revelators say up in the you know, first papers about the Father, about the Atonement Doctrine? How grotesque that is? Well, this is why. Right? Because basically it's still, you're back in that old fixation mode, you know, where you've got this raw leg bone that you're gnawing on. And that's really kind of the extent of the quality of your consciousness there. It's like, wow, that is really crude and disgusting, people. You really could use a better idea of God. You know? And so, you know, they're trying to, I mean, it's important to, you know, to read these things as a, with the recognition of truth. I mean, if you just read all these papers as a fact finder, right, they're a waste, right? You know, and the thing is, if you read them with the eyes of those who recognize this truth, this is where truth gets really rugged, right? When you just read the pleasant tones of Jesus, say, right, you know, you're avoiding the rigors of truth. Right, you see how I'm, you know, I'm saying some very politically incorrect things here tonight, okay? And I'm saying them very definitively. See, it's because this is, you know, this is where the truth is hitting you in rugged fashion. This is where the conflict with your current worldview is trying to be put forward by the Revelators. And so, you know, when everyone skips all this stuff, and even if they do read it, they don't think that there's some sort of truth here that's relevant to them. It's like, well, it's a revelation of truth. What do you think is there? I think it's just some outdated descriptions of archaeology, you know, and we now know none of those dates are correct and blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, for Pete's sake. And, now, I mean, this is, you know, they're trying to really get you to recognize how sorry our ideas of God are, how incredibly limited they are. All right, so, we're, you know, so that one, you know, see, is, like I said, it's very in your face. What do they say next year?
That food was the all-important thing in the lives of these primitive human beings is shown by the prayer taught these simple folks by Onagar, their great teacher. And this prayer was, O breath of life, give us this day our daily food, deliver us from the curse of the ice, save us from our forest enemies, and with mercy receive us into the great beyond.
Okay, so, you know, positive things first, right? Okay, you got the breath of life again, right? And you notice he's introducing something they didn't have initially, right? Something after this life, something after death. And he called it the great beyond. You know, and so the degree to which any human calls that the great beyond today, it's because Onagar taught us that expression. And you notice, okay, I mean, obviously he didn't speak English, right? He spoke Andonite. And what have they done? Very purposely, again, to hit you right between the eyes with a sledgehammer, right? They took Onagar's primitive prayer about fear of ice and forest enemies, and what did they do? Give us this day our daily food. Right. To remind you, of course, you know, of how the Lord's Prayer got corrupted and what it got corrupted to. It got corrupted to the nutrition, back to the nutrition epic. Right? Right. Instead of, you know, as we know, give us this day our bread for tomorrow, refresh our souls with the water of life, right? You lost the parallel to that, right? Which should be obvious if you reflect on the prayer that there's a missing parallel line there. You know, and then the word epiousion in there in Greek that no one knows what it means. You know, so you take that word that no one knows what it means, you know, which should be translated bread for tomorrow, right? You know, the for tomorrow thing, not daily, right? But you just drop back to Onagar's prayer effectively is what they're saying, you know, by basically paralleling the Lord's Prayer in Onagar's prayer. I mean, what he exactly said, you know, and literally that. But that's the truth of what he said. And they purposely make it like, give us this our daily bread. Go, yeah, like there's a great example right there. You know, you think you've made this huge step. No, that's the first prayer that was taught. Right? Do something about my growling belly, Lord. I mean, when Jesus was on the planet, what did all the people want from him? Fish. Free food and free health care. Yeah. That's all they cared about. Right. Did they have a distinction between mind and body? No, all they knew is body. And bodies get sick, right? Diseased, and are hungry. Right. They hadn't gotten above their mind. It's like, your mind gets hungry too and sick. You ever thought about those? Right? Much worse than any disease of the body is a disease of the mind. Have you checked to see if you have a disease of the mind? Or are you just fixated on your body? You really don't even, never even thought about the fact that you had a mind. You're just a body with these parallel feelings going along with it. You're an automaton, right? With a parallel stream of feelings. Right? Is that what is that how you see yourself? Right? It definitely is. If the only thing you're ever interested in, you know, that's even remotely not body is feelings. Right? You don't really care about what's going on in the world as long as it leads to a parallel positive stream of feelings. And if it's a if you have a positive feeling from something, you call it good. If you have a negative feeling from something, you call it bad. Why do you call it good? So you're the definition of good? If you have a positive feeling about something, that defines existential goodness? It's just so immature. So immature. But it starts there, right? I mean, Onagar didn't try to start with worship. He starts with foundational, body-focused prayer, because that's where you have to begin. That's not where you end. That's where you begin. Right? And the irony that instead of making progress with give us this day our bread for tomorrow, she went back to the beginning again. And then you wonder, why haven't we made any progress? Why does it seem like we still languish and stumble along in moral darkness? It's like, well, you keep resetting yourself. You keep dragging yourself back to the beginning. It's the most primitive prayer.
Let's go eat.
Just the whole fear and hunger thing, right, is where it starts. And like they say in paper 118, if the civilization collapses, that's where it'll go back to. Fear and hunger. Right? Let's not look at this as a benighted fact. This is the beginning of something cool, right? There's truth flowing through this primitive prayer back then, right? Because it's a genuine beginning back then. You've got the first teaching about there's something beyond this, right? That beyond, and guess what? It's great, right? See that first recognition of ideals in contrast to ideas, right? That leads to him calling it the great beyond. mean, like I said, he's got the first conscious recognition of ideals and truth. And is, you know, creating a worldview predicated on that recognition. They're constructing a worldview, I suppose I should say. Okay, so really cool, his first prayer. But yes, it starts with breath, you know, quote-unquote mind is initially breath. It took humans a long time to even get remotely something different than that. Okay.
Anagar maintained headquarters on the northern shores of the ancient Mediterranean in the region of the present Caspian Sea at a settlement called Oban, the tarrying place on the westward turning of the travel trail leading up northward from the Mesopotamian southland. From Oban, he sent out teachers to the remote settlements to spread his new doctrines of one deity and his concept of the hereafter, which he called the Great Beyond. These emissaries of Anagar were the world's first missionaries. They were also the first human beings to cook meat, the first regularly to use fire in the preparation of food. They cooked flesh on the ends of sticks and also on hot stones. Later on, they roasted large pieces in the fire, but their descendants almost entirely reverted to the use of raw flesh.
So again, see, they're just emphasizing that this greater reflective mind introduces cooking. And that should be kind of an interesting thing to, you know, just, huh. you know, we kind of take cooking for granted, you know, but to see it as a reflective step, you know. Obviously, there's all kinds of potential advantages, right, to cooking. Like he says, he called it the Great Beyond, like I was stressing there. You know, delightful, you know, they actually give you, you know, so this is an Andonic place name. Right? You know, in the ancient tongue, they actually called that place. And remember, like we've stressed, you know, the Mediterranean Sea was greatly extended. You know, it went, you know, much more to the north and east, and went all the way south. You know, that was connected all the way into the Indian Ocean. You know, it was, you know, very extended back then. You know, and so that's why they couldn't go west very easily from there, where they started there in that, you know, Mesopotamian quote unquote peninsula, you know, where they originated. But you know, just immediately you got missionaries. You know, you just see how, you know, you awaken some genuine religious consciousness, and you know, it has all of these immediate consequences
that we know. One deity instead of
one. Oh yeah, it just. Notice, you know, saying, calling him the breath giver or the breath of life, you know, it's not a very definitively personalized concept yet. You know, so they're just saying, you know, kind of technically it's more of a deity concept. I was going to mention that. Thank you for reminding me of that. So that's just, you know, getting you to reflect on that. It's going to take a while before, you know, there's enough of a more personalized deity concept.
But
it starts, see, with that abstraction, and it starts kind of more philosophically. Remember, deity is a philosophic word, and that there was stressing. See, we've got a budding philosophy that's recognizing this other, capital O, other, the other. Yeah, so it naturally starts as deity, and then you have a greater awakened religion in the wholeness of that philosophy that starts to get that deity personalized more in a genuine way. That you're doing it top down then, rather than just, you know, taking yourself and exalting, you know, getting an anthropomorphic "quote unquote God." This is a more, you know, this is a truer God, because they're starting top down with it. Okay.
Anagar was born 983,323 years ago, from A.D. 1934, and he lived to be 69 years of age. The record of the achievements of this mastermind and spiritual leader of the pre-planetary prince days is a thrilling recital of the organization of these primitive peoples into a real society. He instituted an efficient tribal government, the like of which was not attained by succeeding generations in many millenniums. Never again, until the arrival of the planetary prince, was there such a high spiritual civilization on Earth. These simple people had a real, though primitive, religion, but it was subsequently lost to their deteriorating descendants.
Okay, so you can see that there's that finally that date, you know, and if you flip back to, let's see, where was that? Right there at the in section 5 in the previous paper, you know, it was 993 419 was the birth of Anna Infanta. You know, see, so here you see 983. Okay, see, so it's roughly 10,000. But see, it's 323, and that was 419. And see, so it's actually a little bit more than 10,000, right, between the births. But, you know, like I said, that's why I was pointing out when they say nearly 10,000, you know, there, that's because there was an initial span of time when things were holding together and hadn't started deteriorating. So you just, you know, just notice how they, you know, they just give you those little facts and they challenge you to put the pieces together like that. Even that simple little bit of reasoning, you know, to go, wait a minute, I think I found a, you know, an error in the book. You know, it's actually more than 10,000, not less. You know, see, I mean, that sort of simple-mindedness they're trying to challenge you away from. Here he made it to 69, so you know you almost have that. You know, but remember the longevity was 75. Okay, so they don't tell you how he died, but he almost made that 70 years and 10. Oh yes, yeah, definitely had an adjuster. All right, none of this stuff is, you know, happening without an adjuster. This is kind of, you know, it's pretty fascinating here. You know, the record of the achievements of this mastermind. See, again, you know, how he ends up being on the 420 counselors. Is a thrilling recital. It's like, well, why don't you give it to us? Right? If it's a thrilling recital, and into a real society. See, just saying it like that, real society. So, you know, real means it's connected to eternity, right? He wasn't just extrapolating time upward. He took that leap, right, up to eternity and turned around and started bringing eternity down into time. And so you have a society that's predicated on a recognition of eternity. It's a real society. Just the way they're stressing that. I mean, yeah, it's primitive, you know, in technical terms, but, you know, but it's real. Something we're in danger of losing right now. You know, you got the beginnings of tribal government, you know, efficient tribal government. See, all these things, you know, that efficiency, you know, again, that speaks to how, you know, he has a balance between material consciousness and spiritual consciousness. There's this objective perspective. So it isn't just enlightened, you know, quote unquote, you know, it's pragmatic and faces facts and adjusts them to ideals, right? It's wise. Never again until the arrival of the planetary prince was there such a high spiritual civilization on Earth. And again, see, these simple people had a real, though primitive, religion. See, again, just stressing that real. It wasn't just exalted temporality, right? It was genuinely a recognition of eternity, right? In a very primitive mind, yes. Right? It's primitive, but it's real. Right? And therefore, there's truth there, right? And we're, it's, you know, the problem right now, the emergency is, it's primitive but not real.
Yeah.
It's devoid of truth.
We scrapped that real
good.
Kept that primitive.
Yeah, and see, technically, if you get the factual primitiveness absent the reality, it's pre-primitive. Yeah. See, that's why I always use that term. See, that's what technically is making it pre-primitive. You know, fancy animals that are primitive is pre-primitive. Primitive is referring to humans. Okay, and then again, mentioning that deteriorating descendants, right? That's going to, they'll talk about that as we go forward. And I think, you know, we'll just finish up this last little bit and leave that final section for next time.
Although both Andon and Fanta had received thought adjusters, as had many of their descendants, it was not until the days of Onagar that the adjusters and guardian seraphim came in great numbers to Urantia. This was, indeed, the golden age of primitive man.
All right, so the golden age, quote unquote, was way back then, and it faded quickly. But it does remind you that the whole golden age notion got a very early start. It's like all these other things we've been pointing out. So you started out, we talked about that. Annan and Fanta got adjusters because they were a cut above, you know, even their children. So that you prime the pump, you get it started, and they have adjusters, so then their children can get adjusters, because of that mind context that their parents are giving them. Number of those descendants weren't a high enough quality mind to be father fusers. They ended up being spirit fusers, but still, they got adjusters, right? So there was an ongoingness to them. They had a soul, and could be there was something to resurrect. But see, that gets to your question, John, about Onagar. You know, but it was not until the days of Onagar, right? Yeah. So you've got this exemplary individual that is very definitively a father fuser, right? And he has an adjuster, and he is such an influence that. There are more and more people, like I said, that turn their eyes upward, you know, that are upists, even in this primitive state, you know, remember there's those prerequisites for adjuster indwelling. When you're dealing with primitive people, there's a number of kind of special things, you know, in the grace of supremacy. Where primitive people can get adjusters, like so that they can be a spirit fuser or whatnot. But they're kind of hinting at here is, but in many cases, there has to be something. There has to be a little bit of an upturned mind, right, for that downwelling adjuster to meet. Right, again, the adjuster can't, you know, connect to the top of your head, you know, like as I was saying before, right? You need to be looking in the adjuster's direction. Apparently that's what happened there. He got more of these primitive individuals to turn their minds upward, you know, and think about it that way, not just your eyes, you know, in the analogy I was using, but your mind. It's your mind that you literally have to turn upward, right? Most of, you know, because your mind is initially attuned to your body, right? Your mind is naturally turned downward, right? And that's your natural state. And it stays that way until you grab a hold of it and rotate it upward. It doesn't do that naturally.
That's the lower domain of the mind,
isn't it? Right. And of course, that's, you know, in the hourglass analogy, I mean, that's what you can think about what's in that upper domain is that's mind that's been turned upward, right? It's spiritualized mind. And yes, you're given a little bit of that by grace, right? Yeah, for us at roughly age 6. You know, some of your mind is turned upward by God. You know, technically the creative mother spirit, right? You know, encircling you in the Holy Spirit. She's turning some of your mind upward like that for you. But that's, you know, all that stuff that's done for you is not part of your conscious mind. Right? The challenge is to get some of that upturned mind as part of your conscious mind. It's all wonderful that it's there superconsciously, okay? But you want to take delight in cultivating, getting this part of your conscious life, you know, reflective thinking.
To do that when you're up against the wall.
Yeah. And to be able to maintain that when you're up against the wall. You know, that when the wall is about to hit you in the face, you know, you don't rotate your mind all downward again, and it's all about you.
It's easy to get into that spiral downward.
Right. Again, you have, you know, you're not, spirit gravity doesn't reach into your mind and force it, you know, rotate it upward. You have to turn it upward. Take the light in cultivating. Choose to turn your mind. See, to take that mind that's naturally attuned to your matter and choose to get it so that it can attune to spirit. Right? I mean, the hourglass analogy, that upper face that mind could be attuned to, right? It's spirit substance is above that interface on the top. Right? Matter is below the interface on the bottom. Right? The mind is attuned to that. And attune it up, and choose to turn up. Like I said, I mean, there's an unfortunate bias that religionists have taught us forever. Pray, overemphasizing prayer. Prayer, yes, but not overemphasized because that means you never quite let go of self, right? Enough that natural attunement to the matter. Got to be willing to turn your back on yourself, right? And prayer is keeping you from that. It's prayer is self-reminding. You know, at the very least, I got to glance back occasionally. I can't just turn my head totally and put my. It's like right, you know, someone's got to keep an eye on that. Yeah, you know, self. No, can you trust God enough, right, to turn your back on yourself and look up to the cosmos and consider what's there.
So where's the so heavenly mind, I'm a no earthly good aspect of that?
That's if, you know, you find a kind of a rudimentary way to turn your eyes away from body, but you forget that the whole point is to turn your mind to the cosmos. Allow it, that mind, to be illuminated by the cosmos, and then rotate that down and use that illuminated mind to reform the mind below. Yeah.
The way Jesus talked to that guy Fortune.
Yeah, and the way Jesus told the apostles, no, we need to go down off the Mount of Transfiguration, right? We can't just stay up here so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good, right? You need to take what you acquire from the cosmos and put it into play, right? So you don't want to just, be passively present, with the cosmos, that sort of meditative state. You want to get into dynamic, reflective thinking. The revelators purposely say reflective thinking, not merely reflective thought, to just stress this dynamic element. You know, technically what you want to get is where you get a constant stream flowing down. You actually can get to the point where you can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? You actually have two eyes, one eye on the self and one eye on the cosmos, right? You know, and you have just a steady flow of the cosmos coming down and reforming your mind, Every moment of every day. But initially, you know, you can't do two things at once. And initially, you've got to just get, you know, attuned to this non-self state of mind. And then, but one must do something as well as be something. You know, you got to take it that next step. Don't just
engage.
Right. You know, you're given that ability to have the cosmos reflected in your mind for a purpose. It's not an end in itself, right? Everything is a means to an end, right? Now, what are you going to do with that?
In a cave, and you can bring us there, and you know,
yeah, yeah, and
just forget everything.
And obviously, there. You know, that so heavenly minded, you know, Arthur Good, you know, that feeds into that very unfortunate tendency to basically think of religion as escapism. Right? The point is not to escape from the world. Right, it's to be a cosmic citizen and go out into the world and improve it. Right, but you got to be a cosmic citizen.
So you could call it real.
Not just a.
Right?
What was that?
Real engagement.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're an actuality, but you need to be a reality. You're a self, but you need to be a personalized self. A personalized self is a self that starts at eternity and engages time, and is unnatural. A personalized self is unnatural. Right? That's what it means to, you know, to impose that personalization, that influence from eternity on that temporal self. That makes that temporal self unnatural. Naturally, it's temporal. To illuminate it with eternity is to make it unnatural. You know, and then your challenge is to do that artfully, to make that influence from eternity an art form, artificial, right? To make your mind personality managed, artificial, right? But in the positive true sense of that word, an art form. The cosmos is an art form. It's the grandest art ever. Right? It's sublime symmetry and harmony, right? Right? And you want to discover that artistry and reflect that artistry within you in that upper domain of the hourglass analogy. Right? It's a philosophy. You need to be a philosophy. And in the wholeness of that philosophy, you can be a genuine religionist, a true religionist.
Yeah. Was this achievement, you know, the thrilling recital achievement, it's both pre-Sangic and pre-Planetary Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a new occasion for our experimental world?
Yes.
Satania?
Yes.
Or maybe even...
Right. It's a very the addition of having an awakening like with Anagar, right, in a pre-Sangic race in a pre-planetary prince world, right, that added a very not oft added element to, you know, the total finite. Yeah, that was a very original edition in many ways, yes, yeah. And that was always the plan of the life carriers.
Yeah, a redounding event hailing from 606.
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
Times.
And just, you know, we will wrap up here, but just, you know, that's why, another reason why I was stressing it so much, because, like I said, you know, this is what's so profound about Anagar. He's doing this pre-Sangic, right? It shows you just... you know, how amazing that mustard seed is, right? You don't have to bemoan your lack of biologic uplift, right? You definitely have enough to do what Anagar did, right? And that's why it's just so sad to record, right? So forget about the rebellion and default. It's irrelevant, right? Do what you do something with what you're given. You're given plenty for this little life.
So we don't have to worry about sad to record either, and what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, just,
it doesn't really matter.
Right, just don't worry how many people said, you know, just be the exception to the rule. It only takes a few. It only took one, the case of Onagar, you know, in Onagar's days. It only took one exception to the rule. Right? Be one of those exceptions to the rule. Okay, and then the world will begin to improve. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.